The Tom Woods Show, episode 2278.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and failed to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. It is 2023, as you well know, and that is 100 years since the death of the 29th President Warren G. Harding. So this is a great opportunity to look back on a much maligned and, shall we say, misunderstood President of the United States. We're going to do that with Ryan S. Walters, who is the author of the brand new book, The Jazz Age President, Defending Warren G. Harding. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. I am glad we're having this conversation because everybody says, let's just say people you and I know, will say my favorite president or my favorite 20th century president is Calvin Coolidge. And old Warren gets overlooked all the time. And as you show in the book here, the presidential rankings by historians have not been kind to Warren Harding, who often winds up dead last in these rankings. And some of the reason, and much of the stated reason for that, is the alleged corruption in the Harding administration. Let me just say, before we get into the conversation, even if everything they've said about the alleged corruption of Warren G. Harding were true, it wouldn't even be the tiniest footnote in the book of evil compared to what other presidents have done openly and to the cheers of historians. So I'm sorry, their moral evaluation does not hold a lot of water with me. But let's start there. Let's start with, even though I would say it's only about one third into the book that you get to Harding's presidency, I do want to start with those presidential evaluations. Why do you think, of all possible people, maybe perhaps with the exception of James Buchanan, whom they also hate, why is Harding dead last?
You're right. If you go back to the original, very first presidential ranking, Arthur Schlesinger, 1948, and you move forward, these major rankings, Harding has finished last in more than any other president in more of these surveys. And it's kind of a running battle between him and Buchanan. Of course, you know the problem with Buchanan. He didn't want to invade the South, so he's evil. He's got to go. And my position is most of the people that are doing the evaluating, as you well know, these historians, they're in love with Wilson and FDR, the polar opposite of Harding. Harding's an America firster. You know, we would say today the old right, and believed in limited government and more laissez-faire and economic matters and a non-interventionist foreign policy. And that doesn't fly with most historians. And of course, they tag him with the corruption and some of the other things. And they say he was dumb and a doofus. Of course, you know that is anybody that's to the right of center is automatically dumb. I mean, we're all dumb and the smart ones are on the left side. So he gets tagged with all of those things. And what I found is most people don't know anything about him. Even the historians that rank them, they don't know anything. They know the talking points they were fed in college or grad school. They've never looked into it at all. I can't tell you how many notes I've received and emails from people that said, I had no idea Harding had done so many good things and was actually a pretty good president. So it's just a lot of ignorance as well.
Well, let's go back then in history a bit. As I say, you spend a good deal of time in the book talking about Harding before he became president, and also just setting the stage historically for what was going on in the country, which I think helps some people understand why in 1920 voters would have gone for Harding. So tell us who he was.
Yeah, you're right. You have to put him in context. And I've gotten a lot of people that have, again, sent me emails and said, I didn't know the country was in such bad shape. So it's essential to put him in a proper context, which they deny him that as well. That's one way to sort of dumb down his presidency to say, well, there really wasn't much going on. But he was from Ohio, some small town, Marion, Ohio, got into the newspaper business as a young man, bought a newspaper, the Marion Star, he and two other friends for just a few $100s. And he turned it into a really money-making and successful enterprise. eventually got into politics. He was a delegate to a couple of Republican national conventions. He served in the state Senate. He served a term as lieutenant governor. He lost a race for governor of Ohio before he won the U.S. Senate seat in 1914. So he was in his first term in the United States Senate, nearing the end of his first term when he was nominated president in 1920. So he was a very well-known man around Marion, Ohio. People liked him. He wasn't known as dirty or corrupt or anything. People called him Warren. He wanted people to call him, even when he wasn't held office, he said, don't call me senator or governor or whatever, call me Warren. So that's the way he was. He was known as the kindest man around town, very generous, really a prominent citizen in Marion.
I want to just read an excerpt, if I may, from pages 40 to 41. This is from a private letter that Harding wrote with regard to speculation that he could conceivably be a nominee for president. Can I just do that for a second here?
Yeah.
Because I think it humanizes him. You know, look, I'm not starry-eyed about any politician, but just to read, I think this is authentic, to read the tone of humility that's in this letter is of such striking contrast to the fakery of practically everybody else I've encountered in the political world. He says this, "I expect that it is very possible that I would make as good a president as a great many men who are talked of for the position, and I would almost be willing to make a bet that I would be a more common, sensible president than the man who now occupies the White House. At the same time, I have such a sure understanding of my own inefficiency that I should really be ashamed to presume myself fitted to reach out for a place of such responsibility. More than that, I would not think of involving my many good friends in the tremendous tasks of making a presidential campaign." And then he says, "There are some people who discuss the availability of my name, and I am frank to say I am human enough to rejoice that there are people who think well enough of me to mention me in that competition. More than that, it is a mighty gratifying thing to know that one has friends who are willing to give up their time and their means to back a candidacy. But I should be unhappy every hour from the time I entered the race until the thing were settled. And I am sure I should never have any more fun or any real enjoyment in life if I should be so politically fortunate to win a nomination and election. I'd much rather retain my place in the Senate and enjoy the association of friends and some of the joys of living." I love that statement. Now, of course, he ends up running anyway, but I'm quite fond of that statement. What can we say about his time in the Senate?
Well, that's one of the myths. I tackle 8 myths about Warren Harding in the book, and that's one of them, that he didn't do anything in the Senate. Had a, you know, do-nothing Senate group. He was only there for the one term. And of course, the first 4 years, the Democrats held the majority. And of course, as you know, when you're in the minority, there's not much that you can do. But of course, Republicans took control in 1918 after the war. And he was instrumental in helping stop U.S. entry into the League of Nations. We never ratified the Treaty of Versailles. He was on the Foreign Relations Committee with Henry Cabot Lodge. And when they began the assault of the League of Nations in the Senate, Hodge allowed Harding to make the very first speech against it. He also went with Lodge and others down to the White House to meet with Woodrow Wilson on this League idea and why do we want to get in it. So he was very highly thought of from people like Henry Cabot Lodge. And that doesn't show somebody who's dumb and out of touch and doesn't understand the issues. That shows the opposite. Even while he was a senator, he was the chair of the Republican National Convention in 1916. He gave a keynote address in 1912. So he had done a lot. He was well thought of in the Republican Party, well thought of in the Senate. He was not a backbencher.
Well, let's talk about 1920. First of all, what seems to have happened, I'm getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, what seems to me to have happened was that the general public was probably a bit weary of all the sacrifices and all the crusading and the highfalutin goals of Woodrow Wilson. And so I think the simple message of a Warren Harding, where we're just going to go back to living like normal people again, we're going to have a normal country again, and we're going to have finite, rational goals, and we're not going to presume to have some grandiose utopian vision guiding us, I think that resonated with the general public. But who's he up against in 1920? Who's another plausible Republican?
Well, one of the leading candidates was General Leonard Wood. He had the backing of Theodore Roosevelt, wing of the party. He was well thought of. There were a few other candidates as well. They didn't really have a star that they could put out there, somebody that was just head and shoulders above everyone else. And they figured it would be probably a brokered convention, and it was. And of course, they turned to Hardy. And of course, that's a whole another issue there about smoke-filled rooms and that kind of thing. Of course, there were primaries in those days, and Harding didn't do very well in the primaries, but there were just a handful. Primaries didn't really have much to do with it. You just entered the primaries to kind of show that you had some strength, that you could raise money and build an organization. And there were a few primaries that people would enter, and he did. So coming into the convention, he was a dark horse, to be sure. I mean, he was not on anybody's lips, really, except some of the party leaders who thought he might be a good compromise candidate.
And by the way, his acceptance speech for the nomination is actually a pretty good speech. But because it doesn't hold out any grand vision of domestic or international reconstruction, no schoolboy is required to read it, of course. But I actually think it's a good speech. It's almost never read by anybody. What was it that turned the tide? Why would he suddenly get it? I mean, this somewhat obscure guy from Ohio.
Obscure to the public, but again, inside the party, and particularly his colleagues in the Senate, they thought very highly of him. They thought he would be a good president. Of course, they said, you know, he looks like one. He sounds like one. If you hear his voice, I mean, he's got that really great baritone, you know, unlike my voice. I mean, he's got a very, very nice voice and looks like a president. And that was certainly part of it as well. But he had the right policies as well. People had had enough of Woodrow Wilson. I mean, people had had enough of progressivism. I mean, you go back to, you got Roosevelt and Taft, and then Wilson is progressivism on steroids, and you got this war, and people had had enough of all that kind of stuff. And the Republican Party, the convention had really been captured by these America First, really strong conservatives. Because when they went to pick a vice presidential candidate, they wanted to put some liberal guy on there to sort of balance the ticket. And the convention wasn't having it at all. The convention started shouting Coolidge, 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 and Coolidge got the vice presidential nomination in that manner. So the Republican Party was pushing those policies hard, and they weren't going to put up with any more progressivism. So Harding was a conservative America First guy, and supposedly this smoke-filled room in the hotel in Chicago, which is not true, because the convention had to nominate him. The delegates had to nominate him. And so he had to get the nomination, and he eventually did. It took a number of ballots, but he eventually got the nomination.
So he gets the nomination. Now he runs against the Democratic ticket and wins overwhelmingly, whether you look at the popular vote, the Electoral College, the success of the Republican Party in Congress. It was just a sweep.
Absolutely. Remember, he won the state of Tennessee. That was the first Republican and won a southern state, a former Confederate state since Reconstruction. Even a Memphis newspaper called it an earthquake. So this is not a landslide. This was an electoral earthquake that happened. It was he was the first president to get over 60% of the popular vote. So that's very telling. He was very popular among the people. And I think it's not so much him, but it was the policies again. And Wilson was convinced they were going to win. I mean, Wilson wanted a third term, if you can believe that, even though he had a stroke and all of that. But he got behind Cox and then FDR running as a vice president on the Democratic ticket. And they thought they could run on that League of Nations idea and continuing on, and they would win, but they were blown out. And Republicans maintained control of Congress by wide margins. So it was a Republican sweep for those policies.
So we've got now President Warren G. Harding, the bane of historians everywhere. And what we see him doing is interesting because it's kind of reflected in both his nomination speech and his inaugural address. Again, nobody reads the, who's going to read an inaugural address by Warren Harding? But again, his speeches were actually pretty good in terms of what he was advocating. And he did not think that, even though unemployment had hit double digits and it looked like there was economic trouble ahead, his view was, well, there's going to be a lot of dislocation because of all the dislocation of World War I and all the credit creation. And so what goes up must come down. And so if we try to interfere with this, we're only going to prolong it and we're only going to introduce further distortions. So we have to just let the markets clear themselves out after all this wild credit creation and spending and let things adjust to their natural levels. I mean, that's more or less what he said. I'm paraphrasing. That's more or less what he said. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be more or less what guided him in what he did or did not do.
Oh, exactly. It was a hands-off administration. The only thing they did was remove government from further interference. I mean, they massively cut taxes with Andrew Mellon as Secretary of the Treasury. They massively cut spending. I mean, spending was still about $6 billion a year when Harding came into office, but they slashed it in half to about $3 billion. Now, before the war, the federal budget was less than $800 million. And of course, with Harding and Coolidge, it was around $3 billion. People say, well, gosh, why was it still $3 billion? Well, a lot of that had to do with veterans. We had the Veterans Administration, the Veterans Hospitals, a lot of veterans to take care of. That's where a lot of that spending was. But a lot of the frivolous spending, the unnecessary spending, that was all gutted. So you've got a 50% reduction in spending. You've got a massive tax. Because remember, the top tax rate was over 70% under Wilson. It was an excess profits tax on corporations, a lot of government, a lot of regulations and things. And they came in and just got rid of that and cut taxes massively and reduced regulations. And of course, the economy took off within months. It didn't take long at all. And you can see that reflected in the business community when Harding was elected. Business were finally saying, hey, we can go now. We got an advocate in the White House. We don't have any more of this Democratic roadblocks they're throwing up. So business was really happy right off the bat. So that's why things began to turn around very, very quickly. I mean, the downturn was over by the summer of 1921.
I was very flattered and pleased, by the way, to see myself quoted in your book in connection with this material, because of course I've written a bit about it in the past, because you can draw a lot of conclusions from this. And not so much that you're going to derive an economic law from generalizing from a series of historical events, but rather, if I can find a case where government spending was dramatically reduced at a time when the economy was tumbling downward, and yet it didn't lead to unending catastrophe, then I think that pretty much does it for a theory that says it will. You know, so this really is a rebuke to those who say that in a case like this, you can't even consider cutting spending. Well, not only did he consider it, he did it massively, and we did not get the unending black hole that we were supposed to have got. And I think that, I mean, since that shows that that result does not necessarily follow, then what do we say about that kind of theory? I think it's hard for a Keynesian to explain this away. Oh, they've tried. Oh, have they tried? But it's very, very hard for them to do it.
Yeah, you can read a lot of books about that time period. You can watch documentaries. And it's funny how they'll never even mention Harding and Coolidge. They'll talk about, well, the economy boomed in the 1920s, but they'll never tell you how it boomed or why it boomed. It just boomed, I guess, spontaneously boomed. But you're exactly right. And of course, I had to quote you. You had a great quote about it. And I've learned a lot about economics from reading your books, because I'm not an economist at all. And a lot of other people that wrote about this, but it's hard to find. You know, you don't see it in quote unquote mainstream history, and they just simply ignore it. And you don't hear about it. Most people don't know anything about what happened, anything about his policies. And you have to give his policies credit. And that's one of the things I did with Harding was, like you said, most people think Coolidge is their favorite president, and Coolidge is a good president, but Coolidge just kept the thing going that Harding had started, Harding and Mellon. Of course, Coolidge was part of the administration. Harding brought him into the cabinet meetings. He was, you know, had meetings with him. He was one of the most active vice presidents up until that time. You got to give Coolidge credit as well. But I'm just trying to give Harding the credit he deserves for really getting the ball rolling. As I said, Coolidge just took the baton and kept running after Harding's death in 1923.
It may be hard for some people to believe based on the propaganda they've heard, but a guy like Herbert Hoover was viewed as an interventionist progressive during the 1920s. He was not and never was a champion of laissez-faire. He repeatedly said, laissez-faire is dead. We can't possibly organize our economy or society along that principle. And so Hoover was, as Secretary of Commerce, he was calling for considerable government spending. And by the time it even became plausible that somebody might listen to him, the economy had recovered already. But it is true that Harding did bring somebody like Herbert Hoover in to his administration.
Yeah, he did. He wanted him in the cabinet in some, not in a major capacity, but secretary. He said he actually gave Hoover a choice. You can have commerce or interior, whichever one you want. And he had a lot of respect for his intellectual abilities. And of course, there was some pushback, as I talk about in the book. In the cabinet, Mellon didn't like him. Coolidge never really liked him. And a lot of people in the Senate did not like him. And that was why they said he's a progressive. I think it's Mellon who said he was too much of an engineer, which is what he tried to do when he was president, engineer the economy instead of letting it correct itself. he's very much a progressive. And that's what people need to understand. That's what I teach my students. That's what I try to say in every interview, was that the academic historians, they want to put all three of them together. Harding, Coolidge, Hoover is just their, you know, one great Republican era. But Hoover is not like Harding and Coolidge at all. He did not attack the 1929 downturn in a Harding and Coolidge manner at all, as you well know, with the spending, Reconstruction Finance Corporation, all the things that he did. He was very much a progressive. But Harding thought he could do some good in commerce because of what he had done in Europe and the things he had done there with the Food Administration and helping starving people in Europe. He thought he could be a service in the cabin. And of course, Hoover picked commerce and was there for 8 years.
Can you talk to us about the political scandals? Mm. Not the personal stuff, but the political scandals in particular associated with Harding's name. And to what extent do we legitimately put them at the feet of Harding, or what was really going on here?
Yeah. As you mentioned earlier, and the great Lou Rockwell said one time, Harding scandals, typically Teapot Dome, was rather rinky-dink compared to some of the things we've seen just in the last few decades. And of course, he's often compared to Grant. Grant had just a scandal-filled 8 years in office. But there's a lot of big differences. Harding really had three major scandals. There was one in the Veterans Administration, there was one in the Department of Justice, and there was Teapot Dome, which is the one most people know. And of course, the difference is Grant never did anything about any of the scandals during his administration. He never fired anybody. He allowed people to resign without a penalty. People didn't go to jail. That's not the case with Harding. I mean, the Veterans Administration just involved good old-fashioned graft, corruption, and stealing by Charles Forbes, head of the Veterans Administration, Veterans Affairs Bureau, and built veterans hospitals. He was skimming off the top, and he went to the penitentiary. One of his cohorts in the Veterans Bureau committed suicide over the affair. The Justice Department, they had a secret house in Washington, D.C., where they operated, and they were giving out favors and in exchange for money. It was just bribery involving the Attorney General, Harry Doherty, and his cohort, a guy named Jesse Smith, who also committed suicide. Harding actually confronted Jesse Smith and said, "We're going to have you arrested. You're going to be punished for what you've done. Go home and get your affairs in order." Well, he went home and got his affairs in order, all right. He burned his papers and shot himself. Doherty was tried twice, but had a hung jury both times. He was a pretty smart lawyer. He invoked the Fifth Amendment. This was all after Harding had already passed away. And of course, the worst one is Teapot Dome. And it really was rinky-dink, as Lou Rockwell said. He just got Albert Fall, the Secretary of the Interior, who handed some government oil fields that were supposed to be for the Navy, used by the Navy, and just gave them to two private oil men for drilling and development. And he was bribed for doing so. And of course, Albert Fall became the first cabinet officer to go to prison in American history. And Harding found out about that scandal on a trip out west, a trip that he did not come back home from. He died in San Francisco, died in California. But he had talked to Hoover, and he had found out about Teapot Dome, and his plan was to expose that and do something about it. And look, Harding was a very trusting guy. Harding trusted people. He liked people. He just didn't believe people would do the things that they had done to him. He was very upset about it. He was walking around the White House one time, and he was talking to a reporter, and he said, "You know, it's not my enemies I have to worry about." He said, "It's my friends." He says, "My friends keep me walking the floors at night." So I have to believe that he would have cleaned house in a second term. And you can't really fault him for Teapot Dome. He died before he could do anything about it. But he had talked to Hoover, and he had planned to do something about it when he got back from his trip, but he was unable to do so. So again, his scandals are not huge by some of the things we've seen. And I think Harding, he never benefited from any of it. In most cases, he didn't know anything about it until it was exposed. And he did something about it. That's what I harp on. I say, look, he did something about it. He had people prosecuted and fired and punished for what they did. It's not like he allowed it to continue.
Can we talk about foreign policy here? Because supposedly nothing happened in foreign policy in the 1920s. But some interesting things did happen. Of course, the balance of the 20s was under Coolidge's watch. But how about under Harding?
He doesn't get credit. I wanted to look into his foreign policy. And because I knew there had to be some things. I read a few little tidbits here and there from foreign policy. And I said, well, he's probably got much more of a foreign policy if you just dig a little bit into it. He had a very non-interventionist foreign policy. And of course, people have pointed out to me, I said, well, you know, he voted for World War I. So how non-interventionist could he be? I said, yeah, most everybody else did. And after the war, a lot of Republicans felt duped about what had gone on in World War I. And when Harding was president, he had vowed, we're not doing this again. And as a country, we can never do this again. I mean, he went to the docks in New Jersey where they brought thousands of the remains of American servicemen. And he was in tears on the dock because they were receiving those officially from France. And he said, never again, never again. This must never happen again. And I think a lot of them did feel duped. So he began the process of healing a lot of the problems that Woodrow Wilson had caused. Woodrow Wilson had made a mess of American foreign policy, particularly in Latin America. Mexico, really, we had terrible relations with Mexico. Harding helped to restore that. The president of Mexico was very happy with what Harding was doing and said, this is a new day in American-Mexican relations. And he began to withdraw troops from the Caribbean. We had had troops down there occupying several islands. During the war, he began to withdraw those troops. He withdrew the troops from the Rhineland in between France and Germany. We finalized World War I, officially ending the war. So there were a lot of things that he did that he doesn't get a lot of credit for, particularly repairing relations, because Harding was such a good guy and he was a kind man and he would reach out to these foreign leaders and say, hey, let's start over and let's repair our relations. And that those kind of things happened. And after Harding's death, Mexico and the United States did fully repair their relations and have, because they had, we had severed diplomatic relations. And so those were repaired. So a lot of good things happened in foreign policy. World War I debt commission, he called. That was important because there was so much chronic debt that nations had. And of course, the big one's the Washington Disarmament Conference, sometimes called the Washington Naval Conference, where naval weapons were the big weapons in those. This is before air forces and nuclear weapons are major air forces. Air Force was just in its infancy, but there's no nuclear weapons. So the big feared weapon of the day was battleships and naval buildup. And of course, that was one of the causes of World War I, the naval race between Britain and Germany. So they felt that we should reduce these weapons. And so this conference was called by Harding, met for a number of months in Washington, D.C., and they did get treaties to reduce the world's biggest navies, including our own. We had to scrap a number of ships to get under the limitations. There were a number of treaties that were struck at that conference in Washington to help lessen the tensions, particularly in the Pacific. One diplomatic historian said it probably averted war in the Pacific for 10 years. So there were a lot of good things that he did in foreign policy to repair the breaches and repair the problems that he doesn't get credit for.
So when we assess all this from our point of view, you know, I'm going to find fault with every president on something, but
me too.
Compared to anybody we're likely to get in this day and age, and compared to the vast majority of the presidents we're told were the quote-unquote great ones, he was pretty good. It seems to me there's just no arguing this. He absolutely was pretty good. So this really just has to be a case of historians obviously having an ideological axe to grind.
No, no doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about it. You just look at who these guys are and gals and what they believe and who they like. And they praise FDR, they praise Wilson. And I've told people that don't know much about Harding. I said, if you like Wilson and FDR, you're not going to like Warren Harding. I mean, let me just go ahead and tell you. But if, on our side of the political spectrum, you will. And a lot of people have sent me emails and said, wow, he's now one of my favorite presidents. I didn't know he had done all these things. Because there's so much that he did. Healing the domestic tranquility in the country, that's something else that he did if he doesn't get credit for. The country was in a mess. Racial violence and labor unions and all kinds of things going on. Terroristic bombings that were happening. And he helped heal the breaches. I mean, he worked for civil rights and anti-lynching legislation, all kind of good things that he did for the country that nobody knows anything about. And that's the reason I wrote the book, to show people this man has been maligned worse than probably any other president in American history.
Hey, everybody, quick sponsor message from our friends at Blinkist, who want to help make you the kind of person you really want to be. You want to be the kind of person who seems to know, well, kind of something about everything. An interesting person, an endlessly fascinating person, the kind of person you might ordinarily envy. What if you were that person? Blinkist can help get you there. Blinkist takes thousands and thousands of nonfiction books and pulls out the key takeaways that you can absorb in just 15 minutes. And let's be frank, given how much fluff there is in a lot of books, if you get a good, solid 15-minute overview, well, you've got the real heart of it. Blinkist has a bunch of collections of books on similar topics. So they have one, the 14-Day Personal Growth Challenge, and it's a bunch of books on that. So I'm going through that because, frankly, I find that these books tend to have a lot of fluff and platitudes in them. I just want the 15 minutes. I just want the main ideas. And that's exactly what Blinkist gives me while I'm driving around doing things I'd be doing anyway. Not to mention, they now have Blinkist Connect. You will find titles on Blinkist you'll want to share with your best friend. And with Blinkist Connect, you in effect get two Blinkist memberships for the price of one. Well, just until February 28th, Blinkist has a very special offer just for our audience to help our audience become the people they want to be. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 40% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 40% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. This offer is good through February 28th, 2023 only. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You get two premium subscriptions for the price of one. So at this point, am I remembering this right? You wrote a biography of Grover Cleveland, right?
Yeah, my first book, I wrote a little book about Grover Cleveland, which I've since redid. I totally redid that book. And I'll tell you, my friend, the older I get, brother, the more libertarian I get. I've done a lot of growing in the last 10 or 15 years, owing to you and Brian McClanahan and people like that I've studied. And so I redid the Cleveland book that Abbeville Institute Press put out last year. I wrote a book on the Apollo 1 tragedy, which if you like space, of course, there's a lot of politics in that book. I go into how corrupt the space age was. And so, of course, now I'm working on the political history of the Vietnam War. So, yeah, I started out with Cleveland. He was my first love. So he's one of my top five favorites.
I was wondering about that because now you've got Cleveland and Harding together. So Harding is, you had more of an uphill battle, let's say, in trying to get people to think again. But
no,
I think in the case of Cleveland, most 21st century Americans don't know anything about him. They don't know they're supposed to dislike him. They don't really know anything about him. But Cleveland has many things to be said for him. So I wonder, do you have any further, let's say, you know, I'm going to use the term revisionist work in mind.
Yeah, I hate that term, but hey, if they want to throw it at me, throw it at me. I really don't care. I have thought about a number of things. I know there's a number of presidents I think that haven't got to do. I think John Tyler's a much better president. He's trashed all the time. I think somebody needs to do something on Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson's not nearly as bad, particularly in terms of upholding his oath of office.
All right. Well, if you want to completely destroy your career, go ahead and write that book.
Well, that's why I haven't done it.
Forget it.
Yeah, I probably won't. After a little conversation with Brian McClanahan, I said, man, we'll shelve this one.
He also urged you in the same direction?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yes, sir, he did.
Well, you could do it. You know, you could always, but who wants to use a pen name, really?
Right.
You know, I want my name on that cover.
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm not afraid of these people. A lot of people said the same thing about Hardy. And I've gone on Twitter and tried to goad these guys into debating me. I said, let's just have a debate. Michael Beschloss and people like that. And they won't take debate. I can't remember the guy's name, but he's the former director of the FDR Presidential Library in Hyde Park. Got on Twitter and said what I'd written was total rubbish. But then he wouldn't debate. So he let some woman jump in and debate me. So these guys won't debate. You can't get them to do it. And I guess it doesn't help them. It's not going to help them. So I've tried, but gotten nowhere with that. But, you know, what I'm working on now, again, as I said, is the Vietnam War. So I'm thinking about, you know, I've done a lot of revisionists to try to show that some presidents are have been maligned or much better than we think of them. I think I'm going to do a few like Lyndon Johnson, who are much, much worse than the number 11 ranking that he currently has. So I've got some plans in that direction.
Yeah. Okay. So it doesn't always have to be this guy was better than you thought. It can also be this guy was way worse.
Yeah. I mean, the last ranking, when I saw Lyndon Johnson at number 11, I almost fainted. I thought, you've got to be kidding me.
But the thing with Johnson is there is the multi-volume treatment by Robert Caro.
Yeah.
But it is enormous. You have to be prepared to make a very substantial commitment of time to go through and see all the problems with Johnson. I have a friend who told me that much of what's in Caro's book is summarized, like you can see it anticipated in a much earlier book that is not recommended by anyone these days, of course, because all the books that tell you the truth have just disappeared. But there was a book called A Texan Looks at Lyndon, and that's short-ish, it's manageable, because, you know, a scholar should go through the Robert Caro volumes. And if you're going to do this book on Lyndon Johnson, you should, of course, go through them. But the average person's just not going to do that. I mean, I don't want to devote this much time to a nasty, horrible person, right? So you would be doing the world a service if you could just summarize for us what the case against Lyndon Johnson is, honestly.
Well,
I'm sorry to be giving you, I do this all the time. You know, I'm always giving my guests homework assignments. Hey, you are not obligated to commit to anything here, Ryan. You do not have to commit to anything.
Hey,
I'm not going to follow up and knock on your door and see how it's coming along.
People say, well, what is bad about Lyndon Johnson? I said, well, no, the question is, what's good about Lyndon Johnson? Of course, you probably remember from college and maybe even grad school, I don't know, but I can remember so many times hearing professors say, well, Lyndon Johnson's domestic policy was great. His foreign policy with Vietnam was just a disaster. So kind of a two-sided coin here. No, I think it's all bad. I mean, the Great Society was a disaster. It's still a disaster. It's still costing us money. It's still, I mean, the Great Society, I mean, can we look around at our cities and say that's the Great Society? I don't think we can at all. Of course, my big target is Vietnam. I've been to Vietnam 5 times. I've studied that war in depth. And of course, I used to have the old, I mean, I was a young neoconservative. Hey, we got to go over there and blow those commies off the map, you know, and go over there, study the war, talk to Vietnamese people, and you'll get a whole different perspective on a lot of things. The fact that we shouldn't have been over there at all. The war is nothing but lies, one lie after another. When you read all these documents, these memos, Pentagon papers, it's just tragic. The lies that were told and sold to the people and weren't given the truth. So to me, you know, I'm going to tackle the war first and call it an unnecessary war. And then later on, I'm going to tackle Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson's, we don't have a great society. We have a great disaster. I think he ought to be one of the worst. And really, when we're talking about these things, really, and I think you'll agree with us, you can almost take the presidential rankings and turn them upside down. I mean, you can almost flip them over. As Robert Higgs once wrote, we don't need any more great presidents. If these are your 10 or 12 great presidents, we don't need any more of them. We need the bad ones.
Right, right, right. You can almost flip it upside down. The only person I can think of who might wind up in a screwy place by doing that would be Richard Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
Because they really hate Richard Nixon. But if they looked at him closely, if they looked at him in terms of what his actual policies were, with the exception of the Vietnam War, his domestic policy was not a million miles removed from theirs. They just hate him because they hated him for their own petty reasons, not because of his agenda. Other than Vietnam and being anti-communist, he was a pretty run-of-the-mill, regular, middle-of-the-road Republican.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the problem is. I mean, I look at his domestic policy, the EPA and all of these things.
Well, also the proposal for a guaranteed income.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's not a small change to American life. It didn't get through, but it had his support. So the analogy is not perfect. But in the case of Trump, there are plenty of things that Trump did domestically that were just a continuation of the same old, same old.
Yeah.
But the way you hear these people talk, it's like Trump was me. And I promise you he wasn't. Okay. You would be begging to have Trump back in office if I get in there and started abolishing things. Okay. Absolute guarantee. So Trump's a little bit screwy in the rankings too. I haven't seen a presidential ranking since Trump left office. I can only, maybe old Warren's heading on up now because of Trump.
Yeah. He's the last I saw Harding was on the most recent, he was up to 37. So he was off the bottom rung. He's still in the bottom 10. He's still considered a failure and a terrible president. But we bumped him up to 37th. I'm trying to bump him up a few more spots. I don't know that I can, but I don't know if he can get much higher than 37th. But
well, that's okay. I'm sure if he could see what had been going on, he would take 37. And he'd be very glad that you actually try, not just rehabilitating a person, but you're reporting history here that most people just don't know about. And that's more important even than the good name of Warren G. Harding, is recording history in a way that, you know, more or less sets the record straight and isn't just driven by an ideological axe to grind that in turn is driven by a desire to go get this guy who really was not interested in progressive platitudes or remaking the world. He just wanted to have a normal country. And he was one of the last who advocated having a normal country. Anybody running for president advocating having a completely normal country and everything that that would involve would be driven off the stage. You know, it would be that would be the end of it. You'd never hear from the guy again. Ron Paul's an exception. We do hear from him. He's still going strong at age 87. But by and large, unless you have the unique characteristics of a Ron Paul, you wouldn't even make it to the debate stage if what you wanted was a normal country. But that's what he did want, and that's what he did work toward. So that's why he has to be destroyed. And that's why I'm very happy to see the publication of your book. So the book, once again, The Jazz Age President, Defending Warren G. Harding. I'll have it linked on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2278. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tom. Great to be here.
Hey, everybody, before we go today, I want to let you know about a website that one of my listeners created, and it really moved me when I read the About This blog page. And it reads as follows. The website, by the way, is MidwestSense.com, MidwestSense.com. He says, "My name is Ray Craig, and I'm the father of two young children, a 10-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son. I grew up on a family farm in Iowa and have lived in the Chicago area for over 25 years. I've worked hard and I'm fortunate to have a successful career in computers. My wife passed away 8 years ago, which forever changed our family. I learned tough lessons through hardship, and it is doubtful that I would have grasped many of these concepts without that suffering. Since that time, my perspective on life has changed. I wasn't a bad person before, but my success ladder was leaning up against the wrong wall. I feel I'm finally going in the right direction, where I find myself getting closer to God and Jesus. I started this blog to share things I learn along the way. My interests include philosophy, good habits, education, especially homeschooling, business, computers, and sports, all imbued with Christian values. Along with my own experiences, I'm constantly searching for positive things to read and watch, and will pass those on to readers of this blog. I hope this blog helps at least one other soul on their journey." And he's got his email address there. Again, the website is MidwestSense.com. And he says at the end, "I dedicate this blog to my wife, Christy. She flashed into my life like a shooting star, leaving behind the most precious gifts a man could ever receive." So do please check it out. It'll take you only a second, and I think you'll like what you find there. MidwestSense.com. And if you are considering starting a website, before you start that site, check out the various ways I can help promote it for you for no extra dough, not a cent extra. You got to get hosting anyway. Get your hosting through my link, and I will help promote your site and give you some other goodies also. Get all the details about that at tomwoods.com/publicity. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.